Welcome to the Age of Vision radio show with your host, Wani Clark. We stand together and accept we now live in a world transformed by the nuclear industry. We expose and confront the intentional neglect and disregard for life on our planet by atomic energy. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action to save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Every voice matters. Our actions matter. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear. Good afternoon. This is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Vision radio show. I want to thank everybody for joining us. I am very excited to have with us Mr. Harvey Wasserman, and he is a historian, an activist, and actually a talk show host, and I would say an activist in the anti-nuclear movement, or the New Truther movement, as I call it. He is also the author of a new book called The People's Spiral of U.S. History. And Harvey, thank you for joining us. I really appreciate your time here.
My pleasure.
Yeah. So I want to ask you, because I have this particular interest in the nuclear denial, because I am completely dumbfounded. I was like most Americans. I came in, I thought our government was handling nuclear waste. I thought it was no problem. After Fukushima, I even believed Barack Obama when he said everything was fine. And I only found out like a year afterwards that things weren't fine. And then I started getting involved. And after about 2 years, I ended up with this radio podcast and I started doing further research. And I've discovered that there's almost like a blanket nuclear denial about the harm that nuclear causes the planet. And in fact, in the climate collapse conversation, nobody discusses the effects of nuclear contamination on the climate. There's barely a part, no conversations on that. So that's one thing. And then the other part of that is there is very little youth involved in this. Most of everybody that we talk to are older people. I myself am 64. Almost all the activists are older people. Do you have any, you're a talk show radio host, you're out there, you've been an activist for a long time. Do you have any feel for, A, why that is and how we can break that model?
Well, the nuclear power issue is a generational thing. It came to life here in the U.S., the No Nukes movement, in the 70s. And, you know, it's a lot to learn. It's complicated. And we're really down to not fighting new nukes. So the idea that they're going to build new nukes is ridiculous. It's just not going to happen. They're too expensive. They're too slow to build. And they're too complicated. It's just, you know, so I, of course, oppose new nukes, but I don't spend much time on it because these guys are just blowing smoke, as it were. So the younger generation doesn't really relate to the nuclear issue the way they do to global warming.
Yeah, but this is my point.
The climate issue.
The global warming, I really believe that you can't tell me that 80 years of nuclear contamination and ongoing contamination is not affecting the climate collapse. I mean, there is no way that nuclear contamination is not affecting the biology of this planet. And so the fact that it's not even part of the discussion, and I understand that the younger people weren't part of the implementation of nuclear power plants, but, you know, we do have these SMRs that they're trying to sell us, which are, again, a dead end. SMRs are the small modular reactors, which the Navy and the Army are definitely building. They're putting them up, and there is one being built in Utah, so that they are doing them. They're moving full steam ahead. But the conversation about every time we talk about nuclear, most of the time it's about the cost and how it's breaking the bank. And In fact, that's the conversation I got into with the Natural Resource Defense Fund when they were lobbying along with the nuclear industry to keep their leaking nuclear power plants open so that the NRDC's goal of closing down coal could be accomplished. Like, they were completely exclusive to the idea that it is part of the contamination of our planet. I mean, we have massive amounts of birth defects, autoimmune diseases, diabetes, schizophrenia. All these things are caused by nuclear contamination. And yet, you go to your doctor, they will never tell you that.
Right. And but, you know, you've also got other things coming in, like 5G, GMOs, and things like that. So the problem that we have with the nuclear issue is that the number one item, the number one agenda item that we have is to shut the operating reactors. And so, you know, there's 96 commercial
right.
reactors that are licensed to operate in the United States. And all but one of them is more than 30 years old. So,
right.
Even the one that's not 30 years old, Watts Bar, they were building for 30 years. So, but there, right. effectively, there are no new nuclear plants under construction, except for Vogtle in Georgia, which is, a catastrophe in every way, shape, and form. And, is going to cost them close to $30 billion. And we did shut the two, we stopped the two in South Carolina. So for, it's very unglamorous and really hard to get your head around, try and shut, operating reactors. In fact, I have a problem here in California where, there's two reactors at Diablo Canyon and the deal was cut to shut them in 24 and 25. But I'm getting, there's a group here in Southern California, also, you know, like an AARP group, I mean, older people generally, that are trying to shut these two reactors. But we always run into people, I even had a former U.S. senator tell me that they've already been shut. I mean, she was completely wrong. So, it's treading water to get people focused on closing down operating reactors. And then you have these clowns running around saying that, you know, nuclear power fights global warming and then it's zero emission, which is a complete lie. It's hard to combat that. And it's not sexy. It's hard to really get people excited about it the way we were excited about stopping nuclear construction, which we were very successful in doing.
Right.
I mean, I was living on a communal farm in western Massachusetts in 1973 when they came in to build two reactors nearby. And now that's where we coined the phrase no nukes. And, we were able to get a movement and we had people getting arrested and mass demonstrations and all that stuff. And at the time, Richard Nixon said there'd be 1,000 nuclear power plants in the United States by the year 2000. So in the year 2000, there were 104. So we were pretty successful. Unfortunately, of course, all it takes is one nuclear plant
right.
to wipe out millions of people and trillions of dollars. And we're in that position now. The plants that we couldn't stop, including Diablo Canyon, are positioned to inflict apocalyptic damage.
That's true.
And anybody who, for example, and if you really want to see a graphic exposition of what can happen with the nuclear industry, people should see the feature series on Chernobyl.
Yeah.
That was run, I think it was HBO did it. I mean, it's incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
Very, very widely watched, by the way.
Right.
And so we live in terror of these continuing reactors, but it's hard to get people. First of all, it's very, very hard to shut an existing power plant.
Well, I don't know what yours is like at Diablo Canyon, but the one up here in Columbia Generating Station sits on the Hanford Reservation, and they discovered the Physicians for Social Responsibility did their own study because there had always been rumored that it was sitting on active earthquake fault. Turns out it is. It's surrounded by active earthquake faults, and it's only 11 miles away from Hanford, which means if we even have a mild nuclear meltdown caused by an earthquake, Hanford is going to have to be evacuated. And Tom Carpenter from Hanford Challenge agreed with me that we could potentially have one of those tanks explode and we'd have a fire for 750,000 years that would contaminate the entire Northern Hemisphere. Now, when I found that out, I got active with a group up here in the Northwest to try to close down the Columbia Generating Station, only to find out that it's a consortium of 57 utility companies. I mean, they all have to agree to close it down, and they're all pro-nuclear, and so you can't even get in to see the Bonneville Power Station, which is the people that are kind of overseeing the consortium. They really literally will not even make appointments with you. So it's a really difficult challenge, as you say. How did Diablo Canyon get decided to get closed down, if you don't mind bringing our listeners up to speed on that one?
Well, what happened is that there was a first of all, Diablo Canyon is in California.
Right.
So, we had 10,000 people arrested there.
Oh.
You still, you still commonly meet activists here of a certain age who were arrested at Diablo Canyon, including me. I was arrested there. I didn't live in California at the time, but I was arrested at Diablo in 1984. I spent three lovely nights in the San Luis Obispo County Jail. And, it was a rite of passage in the 70s and 80s to get arrested at Diablo. The bottom line is that they're losing money there. That's the one thing that's really working in our favor. I start to talk, as you just did, about the dangers of Diablo, which is surrounded by earthquake faults. It's 45 miles from San Andreas.
Right.
There was just a 7.0 at China Lake, which is less than 200 miles from San Luis Obispo.
Oh,
I mean, if that quake had hit at Avila Beach instead of Ridgecrest, L.A. would be a smoldering ruin. And the fact is that, you can talk about Hanford, but if Diablo goes, God forbid, the cloud comes into Los Angeles. And, that's it.
But I hear what you're saying. It's really more of the way to get them closed down is to talk about the cost. I know it. I have an activist friend, Nancy Newell, up there in Portland. You know, they passed a law here in Oregon that said Columbia Generating Station has to stay in the black. It can't run at a negative. And it's losing $500 million a year. We're subsidizing it.
Yeah, so is Diablo Canyon. And it's getting worse because what's happening now is that the high operating maintenance costs are combined with the deterioration, physical deterioration of the reactors. So it gets worse and worse. And meanwhile, one of the great, I almost have to call it a miracle of our age, is the incredible technological leaps in renewable energy. I mean, when we first started in the 70s, people would say, well, if you're not going to have nuclear, where are you going to get the energy? And we'd say, well, wind and solar. I mean, we're really talking through our hats. And the technology has just exploded.
Right.
It has exceeded all expectations to the point now where new wind, it's cheaper to build a new wind or solar facility than to continue to operate a nuclear plant. And this is straight out flat economics. So Diablo, just a court filing, is clearly losing. Let's put it this way. The electricity produced by Diablo is coming in on an annual basis. Well, in this year, in 2019, the electricity produced by Diablo is going to cost more than $520 million over market.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's just staggering. So that's, but now I circulated a petition. We had a group here asking the governor, our great liberal governor, Gavin Newsom, to merely inspect the reactors, because we know
right,
unit one is embrittled and it's cracked. It's deferred maintenance, which has become PG&E's trademark. They can't deal with their nuclear waste. They got the seismic issue, we can't get. Among the people who signed it are Mimi Kennedy, Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin, Francis Fisher, Jody Evans, Lila Garrett. I mean, it's Martin Sheen, Ed Begley, Ed Asner. You know, Graham Nash. I mean, an insanely powerful group of Hollywood stars. We got zero response from the governor. He hasn't even responded to the petition, and we can't get any coverage from the media. It's astounding.
It is astounding.
So nobody wants to talk about the dangers.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was talking about, is the nuclear denial. It's like even somebody like a liberal governor of California, as soon as he gets into office, he clicks his heels and says Sieg Heil and does whatever the nuclear industry wants. And, you know, even though he's opposed to Donald Trump, you know, was it a year or a year and a half ago? I think it was last year he signed it. It was recently as last year. He signed an executive order stating that the United States is going to support nuclear energy, that we will bail out these nuclear facilities.
Right.
And so...
Well, a big part of the problem is, I hate to say it, the unions. You know, I'm a union man. I'm a union supporter all my life. But the workforce at the nuclear plants, including Diablo, is unionized. And so you have 1,000 people, mostly men, working at these reactors, and they don't want to shut them. There's 1,000 high-paying jobs. You say, well, get the jobs in renewables, but the jobs in renewables are not unionized, and they're much lower paying, and they're not secure, at least in the eyes of the union guys. So you have a very, very powerful union lobby demanding that these, and they also have pension fund investments here that are affected if the reactor's shut. So.
Oh, really?
That's a big problem. It's a core problem in shunning reactors. And so, but what happened here, this being California, and all the issues do have some resonance. I mean, people understand earthquakes here, nobody believes that Diablo or any other nuclear plant could withstand an earthquake. And that Diablo, of course, the cloud goes right into L.A.
Right.
So.
I'm from L.A. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, so we're looking here at sufficient critical mass to force, and then you got PG&E. And PG&E, you know, is a horrible nightmare. They burned down Northern California. They blew up San Bruno. You know, they're a criminal corporation, literally a criminal corporation.
Right.
They were convicted of a number of felonies related to the San Bruno fire of 2010, which killed 8 people. And now, you know, this nightmare up in Northern California, and they're bankrupt. So all that allowed us, Friends of the Earth and other A4NR and so on, to go in and force a negotiation with the town, the union, the company, the state, to shut them down in 2025 when their license expires. Now, there are also some, state regulations, that they were able to finesse by cutting this deal. So had they not cut this deal, PG&E, the state agencies would have shut them down, earlier, and they should have shut them down. You know, we're not happy about that. And Gavin was on one of the state agencies that allowed them to avoid doing an environmental impact review. And, you know, and people yelled at him, and he got a bug up his behind about this. And so he doesn't like to talk about Diablo. He won't talk about Diablo because, you know, he did what he thought was the right thing and then got yelled at by the anti-nuclear movement. So, you know, he was party to the deal that would shut Diablo in 25. When their license is done, but he won't entertain talking about shutting it earlier, which, you know, I'm terrified. We're all terrified.
Right.
It's 2019, so we got 6 more years, and, you know, who knows when those earthquake faults are going to go off.
I mean, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. You were exactly right.
So what's happening now is we have discovered one of the groups that was a party to the deal to shut down in 2025, a group called Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility, has a very good lawyer named John Geisman, who was involved in the Public Utilities Commission, you know, under Jerry Brown. And he has just filed a brief, which is really worth looking at. Go to the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility website, a4nr.org, pointing out the incredible cost of continuing to run Diablo. I mean, it's literally, they will overmarket this year almost $530 million. And that's charitable.
I mean, that's every nuclear power plant. I think every time I've talked to anybody about a nuclear facility, it seems to the complete disregard for fiscal responsibility or safety seems to be tantamount throughout the entire nuclear industry, anywhere I've looked in the last 5 years. In fact, in 2012 or 13, I think it was 13, I was doing research for a college paper, and I found a scientific study by a group of scientists in Spain, 6 scientists. Turns out that the IAEA safety culture model had never been empirically tested. It had 8 markers of safety. So they decided to test it. They got a nuclear facility in Spain to test this safety model. On all of the markers except for one, they failed. And the one that they passed 50% was that the workers felt like they could talk to their employers about a problem that they saw on the facility.
Well, that wouldn't be true here in California. I mean, you have a situation at Diablo where, you know, the NRC has site inspectors at every reactor. And the site inspector at Diablo wrote a memo saying, listen, I don't think that this plant can withstand a credible earthquake.
That's awesome.
And they totally trashed the guy and sent him back to North Carolina back east, and he's gone. He's no longer with the NRC.
So they basically got rid of somebody who was doing his job accurately.
Exactly.
Wow.
Because they can't handle, you know, the reality of it.
Do you know if the safety inspections at Diablo have been reduced since Trump has? I know that at the Hanford and all the legacy sites, the Department of Energy is now preventing the National, I think it's called the National Defense Oversight Board, from going onto the legacy sites without permission, and the employees are no longer allowed to talk to them. And I know that happened around the same time the NRC was told to reduce their inspections. Do you know if there's still inspections going on at Diablo?
Whenever an inspection comes up, a periodic inspection comes up, the company asks the NRC for a variance or a waiver.
Wow.
And the commission does. I mean, there's a guy in Michigan, Michael Keegan, who tracks this stuff. And, the commission, there are 5 commissioners on the NRC, and the way it's set up is that the president appoints 5 commissioners approved by the Congress. And when you have a Republican commissioner, a Republican president, you have 3 Republicans and 2 Democrats. When you have a Democrat, there's 3 Democrats and 2 Republicans. That's how we wound up with Greg Yasko for a while under Obama. And they forced him out because he actually did his job.
Right.
And so like Michael Peck. So, the commission, which was always a rubber stamp, has even less credibility now than ever.
Wow. Well, listen.
So the deal at Diablo did involve the town, the union. It was a complicated deal, but a good deal. And one of the great things, and to a certain extent, you know, I supported the deal as an interim step to, you know, a quicker shutdown.
Mm-hmm.
And now, because of the changed economic situation, and this is critical, A4NR, which was a party to the deal, is now asking that they shut earlier, which was always, allowed. And the reason that is that not only is the power from Diablo insanely expensive, but it actually is detrimental to the grid because, as you know, a nuclear plant is either up or it's down. You know, it's always that if it's operating, it's going to be operating, to put large chunks of electricity on the grid. But the grid demand is fluctuates, just like anything else. And so when you have this lump of power from Diablo on the grid and demand sinks below what the grid is putting out there, they shut down the wind and solar facilities. And so, we're continually having situations where when demand drops, they because all this power from Diablo is out there, they're forcing these wind and solar plants to turn off.
Wow.
It's ridiculous. And so this whole crap that's being pushed by these clowns, that nuclear power is somehow fights global warming is completely wrong. You know, all nuclear plants emit heat. They emit carbon and they emit radiation. And
not only that, they use a lot of fossil fuel after they're finished because it takes a lot of fossil fuel to maintain and deal with, the ongoing issues of maintaining them. It's from cradle to grave.
Well, also to create the fuel.
Right.
The enrichment.
So cradle to grave, they're completely not green at all. So. Well,
exactly.
Well, you guys have been listening. This is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Fission Radio Show. I want to remind you, and my guest today is Harvey Wasserman. Harvey has a website, and I forgot to mention it at the beginning at the top of the hour. It's called Solartopia. I encourage everyone to go there. I'll have a link of all these things in our podcast notes, and that's where you can find his archives to his radio show. So I strongly suggest that you go there. And Harvey, I want to give you a little bit of time to talk about your book, The People's Spiral of U.S. History.
Right. So this is a book I've been working on actually for 50 years. When I was a grad student of history way back in the late 60s, I came across a book called The Contours of U.S. History, Contours of American History by a professor named William Appleman Williams. He was at Wisconsin. And then, of course, I read Howard Zinn's great stuff. And I came up with a theory. Well, William Appleman Williams' theory that American history goes in cycles. And I worked with it and have turned it into something a little different. But I actually corresponded with Professor Williams about it. I actually have an archive at the University of Massachusetts, and I have his letter in it, along with a letter from Howard Zinn. And so I refined over the past 50 years. I taught at two colleges in Central Ohio for 14 years. This idea that U.S. history can be dissected into six easily understood cycles, and I also came to believe and very strongly do. That actually American democracy derives from the indigenous. There were no countries in Europe and no move for democracy that had anything, was in anywhere tangible on a scale or depth that we saw in the Iroquois Confederacy. The Iroquois Confederacy was a congress of five tribes in what's now upstate New York, stretching from Albany across to Buffalo. It was the Mohawk, the Oneida, the Onondaga, the Cayuga, and the Seneca. And they were always at war, and then either a real guy or a mythological holy man came. His name was Daganoweda, and persuaded the tribes to stop killing each other and to form a congress, a confederacy. And the confederacy is extremely democratic. It's made matriarchy run by the women. The men were the chiefs, but the women chose them and could remove them. And I saw a documentary film. They asked an Iroquois woman why is it that if the women run the tribes, the men are the chiefs? And she said, well, it gives them something to do, and it makes them feel important. when the French saw the French really loved the Iroquois. They loved the Indians, actually. They got along they had plenty of wars, but they got along generally very well, and they were inspired by the Indians. And some of the Brits were, most of the Brits were, turned a real blind eye to the indigenous and treated them, you know, like farm animals, basically. But a few of them, and most importantly, Ben Franklin, understood how sophisticated and advanced the governmental system of the Iroquois really was. He said that he was quoted, for a white man to say this was quite revolutionary, but it was Ben Franklin who, as far as I'm concerned, is the most important figure in Western civilization in modern times. Ben Franklin, he's an astounding individual, and he basically said, and he was right, that the Iroquois Confederacy ran better than the British Parliament, and so he used it, as did Washington. Actually, Washington was an Indian killer, but he also understood and respected, because he fought against them, how advanced they were. And they used the Iroquois Confederacy as a model for the American Constitution. I mean, the whole congressional system is based on the Iroquois Confederacy.
Yeah.
And American democracy, as far as I'm concerned, in my book, The People's Spiral, is rooted in the indigenous. And so what I posit that American culture, American history, is based on a back-and-forth dynamic between the very, very tolerant, you know, gay-friendly, women, matriarchal, at one with nature. The Indians, no indigenous tribe understood, had any concept of private ownership of land. I mean, the whole stewardship idea. I mean, the Indians came from them. They were basically culturally and spiritually indivisible from nature, as opposed to the whites, especially the Puritans, who came here with this idea that human beings were somehow separate from nature and should dominate
and superior. And so to the nature. All, yeah.
Superior, yes, and to other people.
Right.
You know, the Indians didn't have that belief, and you know, there were hundreds and hundreds of tribes, clans, nations, confederacies throughout North America. There were no cities, except for one fairly large town on the Mississippi River near St. Louis, called Cahokia. Unlike the Aztec and the Inca, the North America was just basically villages and communal groups. So the idea of my vision of American history in The People's Spiral is that it's a back and forth dynamic between the indigenous and the Puritans, who are male dominated, technological. You know, the Indians did not develop advanced technology because they didn't believe, they had no sense of dominating nature. They were master agrarians. I mean, nobody was better farmers in the history of the world than the indigenous.
Right.
And you had communities, villages in the Iroquois country there, where they had 6 square miles of corn. I mean, you know, and also
they also had different kinds of corn. You know, it wasn't just like one type of corn. There was like a lot of different kinds of potatoes and a lot of different kinds of corns that have just gotten homogenized in the modern era for simplicity's sake. So that, you know, they could mono farm. Or I mean,
right. They also didn't keep animals.
Right.
They manipulated the forest. They actually got rid of the trees. They girdled the trees that they didn't want, and they promoted the trees that were productive for fruit, for vines, for medicine. You know, aspirin comes from willow bark.
Right.
The whole medicinal range they had was all plant based. They did practice abortion. Women, as I say, dominated the tribes, and I'm not going to say it was paradise, but they had plenty of wars and things like that. But there was no class system.
And there was also no real slavery, and you know, like they did take slaves, but people were expected to leave. You know what I mean? They traded them back or whatever. You know, when they
well, the women and the children, that were captured in battle, they integrated.
Right.
And then the men, the Iroquois, in some cases, you know, if you were really really brave and you were captured, they basically ate you. So that stuff the Iroquois, the current Iroquois, are, you know, remorseful about. Let's put it that way. So, but they were and remain incredibly advanced. I mean, the indigenous are still very much at the heart of the environmental movement
in this country. Well,
they need to be because more
than 60% of the uranium mines are on their lands. So they, you know, they have been dumped on the greatest. I mean,
right.
They have been grotesque. I consider the nuclear industry to be an assault. It is really literally a battery of our nation. I mean, we're the only nation that actually bombed our own land, and then they dug up all the dirt and brought it to the Marshall Islands, and that's its own little story. That's a catastrophe. So it's
well, the French, the Russians, the Brits, India, probably Israel, Pakistan. They've all exploded nuclear weapons on their own land, and it's not a pretty picture. We, of course, led the way, and then the Russians. The Soviets came right away, and so it's not. But nuclear power and weapons are not just an assault. They're
but
suicide.
The Brits didn't. All those other nations didn't bomb their own nations where they live. They bombed their territories, right?
So we brought it back. Well, except for the Russians.
Right,
I mean,
except because the Russians just so gigantic. They just, you know, like it's.
Right. We brought it back to Nevada. That was
exactly.
We started in the South Seas. I mean, we started in Japan. Well, actually, no. The first nuclear bomb was exploded in New Mexico.
Right.
In July of 1945. Then we did two in Japan. Then we went to the South Pacific. But in 1952, we brought it back to Nevada.
And I actually consider the nuclear waste to be sort of like little nuke bombs. You know what I mean? Like Chernobyl went up in smoke, but I know for a fact, like every one of those canisters, every one of the storage tanks, they have 1,000 Chernobyls, enough cesium-137 in all of them. And they all leak. I mean, thanks to the work of Donna Gilmore, we now know that the Holtec canisters that we store our nuclear waste in start leaking at 20 years. Most of the waste has been in there for 13 to 15 years, and some of them are at 18. And we are going to start seeing, it's going to be like popcorn. They're just going to start popping, you know. I mean, I have a sense of urgency. That's why I do this podcast. I have a sense of urgency to want people to understand. I didn't play my intro because we're pre-recording this, but in my intro I say that happiness is resistance. I want to be able to bring this out of the closet so that we can talk about it without being fearful. Most people shut down because they're so afraid of it, but my thesis is that there's a lot to live for. Just because we're in the stew, the nuclear stew, doesn't mean that our lives are miserable and we're all going to die and get sick. And I mean, we are going to have a lot more deaths and cancer and illnesses. That doesn't mean we cannot thrive and have a magnificent life. You know, some people will get sick quickly. Some children will have birth defects. But we can manage our lives as human beings and still face this horrible thing that has been basically shoved in the closet by every industry and every segment of society.
Well, not every segment. We've had opposition, and that's part of the cyclist theory, is that you have the way it works is this. You have a period of materialism and decay, and it starts in the 1680s, and when you have a glorious revolution, an uprising in England that affects us here. And then here in America, the whites overthrew their colonial governments along with the overthrow of James II in England. And you start, then you have a period of green, a springtime uprising where things like environmental and nuclear issues are dealt with and people do rise up. And it's an arising and awakening of spiritual feminist music, sexual, cultural upheaval, and political upheaval for equal rights, often race-based. And that happens in America in the 1730s and 40s. You have the Great Awakening a spiritual uprising in which actually blacks and women participated, and the fight, John Zenger's fight for freedom of the press. And that leads into a hot summer, from a springtime into a summer of conflict, resolution and war, in this case, the revolution. Then it's always followed by an autumn, a fall of reaction. After the revolution, we had the coming of the Constitution. I am not a fan of the U.S. Constitution. I love the Bill of Rights. I think the First Amendment is actually the greatest single sentence ever written. Congress shall make no law respecting establishment of religion and so on. But you do have the retrenchment of the rich white planters and bankers in the U.S., followed by a winter of materialism and decay, where, you know, we had the era of good feelings, we had Jefferson's presidency and Madison, and where people just kind of forgot about any kind of progressive politics and just wanted to basically consolidate their fortunes and get rich. And now that breaks down. There's always an economic crash. In this case, it was in 1819. And then you had the coming of a strong, somewhat, well, allegedly progressive leader, although in this case, Andrew Jackson was a horrible racist pig, really our second worst president, as far as I'm concerned. Our worst president, by the way, by far, worse than Trump and worse than Nixon, was Woodrow Wilson. And he was an incredible reactionary. He killed the socialist movement literally by force, and loved the Ku Klux Klan, and got us into a world war, which he used as a cover to destroy the radical labor movement. But anyway, so after this era of good feelings, you have a thaw, a crash. Jackson comes in. There's a whole upheaval. You have a in springtime, you have a transcendentalist movement. Again, great literature, the arts, women's rights, a sexual revolution. You even had hippie farms back in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, where everybody slept together. There was one hippie farm where the guy who was sort of the principal figure kept a written log of everybody who slept with everybody.
Wow.
And then he had to leave town, as you might expect. So, and then you have the rise of the abolitionist movement. It leads to the Civil War, the hot summer of conflict. We do abolish slavery, and then, of course, there's a reaction there. Congress, run by radical Republicans, attempts to reconstruct the South, but the South rises, the Ku Klux Klan comes up, you have an intense reactionary period in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s, where the corporations essentially take over the country. There's another crash in the 1890s. You have the rise of a springtime of the socialist and bohemian movements, another cultural upheaval and radical left politics trying to get social justice. Unfortunately, it's crushed by Woodrow Wilson, who comes in 1912 and gets us into World War I, which was vastly opposed by the majority of the people in the country. And he uses World War I, which was actually just a complete lie. Everything about it was a lie.
Right.
And uses that as cover to destroy the socialist movement. You know, most people in the United States assumed we would eventually have a socialist president. We had a wonderful leader named Eugene V. Debs. He was widely loved everywhere. Wilson threw him in prison and used a fascist Gestapo to essentially destroy the socialist party. And then you have the winter again in the 1920s. That breaks down in 1929 with the Great Crash. In comes Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt with the New Deal, a very socialistic, progressive, you know, had limitations, but it did a lot of good. Happy days were here again, all that stuff. And the Roosevelts were extremely progressive. Eleanor Roosevelt in particular, I think, is the most important female in world history in many ways. I mean, she's just extremely progressive, social justice oriented, culturally advanced, may have had, several, female lovers, as time went on, and set the stage for the United Nations. You have World War II, of course, another hot summer, of social upheaval, followed by another fall reaction with the McCarthy era and the anti-communist House Un-American Activities Committee, all that stuff. And then it breaks down in 1957. You have, while Eisenhower is the president, you have a recession. And the cycle starts again in 1960 with John Kennedy. A mixed bag in the beginning, but Kennedy very quickly evolved. I think John Kennedy, had he lived, would have been a truly, truly great president. And,
Would you say that now with Trump we're in the darkness, like we're in the winter?
Yes. Well, The thing that's going on with the this time period, and basically the cycles end in 1992. Mm-hmm. The American democracy, essentially as we knew it, essentially ends in 1992 with the Clintons, because Clinton comes in and he should have been a burst of energy, another springtime upheaval. But in fact, if you look at his administration, which I did, he accomplished absolutely nothing. There were no social programs. Right. We've had no social programs.
That's right.
To benefit the working middle class.
He sent us way backwards. He was the Trojan horse. For real. He sold the Democratic Party. Yes.
He sold the Democratic Party to Wall Street. You know, he's now worth $100 million. And, you know, talk about Trump's corruption.
I mean, he's the reason why we have Fox News. It's why we have a media that's controlled by just a handful of people. I mean, he's why we have the prisons for profit system. He's why we have the education for profit. I mean, the whole system, he upended everything.
Yeah, the only thing that built, he did broker peace in Northern Ireland, which was a great accomplishment. Other than that, he accomplished nothing except to inaugurate a national debate on oral sex. That's Bill Clinton's great legacy. And then, of course, in 2000, the election was stolen, and the corporate Democrats said nothing. I mean, basically, what happened in 1992 is that the Democratic Party was sold to the corporations.
Right.
Whatever oppositional energy was involved with the Democratic Party disappeared with the Clintons.
Yeah, Democrats mad. You start saying that the Democrats of today are Ronald Reagan Republicans, to be honest. That's how I feel about
them.
They
are.
And
yes,
I've gotten some horrible flack from people. You know, people. I'm a very big supporter of Bernie Sanders. I think that he could right the ship if the DNC would allow him to win the primary. I mean, but I'm going to vote for Bernie, but I am not under any illusion. And I'm not, like I say, happiness is resistance. I am not going to let them destroy my happiness because the fascists control our nation. You know.
Well, you got to remember also that Bernie is really just a New Deal Democrat. I mean, he calls himself
That's
socialist,
right.
but he's really not.
That's right.
And his politics are not particularly.
He's a Democrat, actually. He's what Democrats used to be, like for real.
Well, he's from the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, which was Paul Wellstone's phrase, the senator from Minnesota. And I knew Paul Wellstone, and I happen to believe that it's very high likely that he was murdered. I mean, one thing about this
I agree with you.
This book, I have at the end of the book, I have a section called Conspiracy Theories and Actual Conspiracies. And the reality is that every war that we've been in, the Mexican War, the Spanish-American, the First World War, the Second World War, the Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, all based on lies.
All wars.
I mean,
lies.
You know, we were never attacked.
That's right. But even being attacked and creating a war is a lie. Like, all wars are lies in my view. I'm very much, I think wars are lies. They destroy culture, period. That's the goal of war. And make war profiteers very, 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 very rich.
Well, they take the progressive energies of the awakened springtimes and turn them into armed conflict.
Right.
And then, you know, there are allegedly some steps forward. I mean, during the Civil War, we did actually abolish chattel slavery. And it was a big deal. And, you know, unfortunately, the two seminal presidents that we look to, Lincoln and Kennedy, did not have second terms. So, you know, unlike Franklin Roosevelt, we can evaluate Franklin Roosevelt. We knew who he was. We knew what he did. We knew what he believed. You can't do that for Lincoln and Kennedy. They brought certain beliefs into a certain framework. You know, Lincoln made racist remarks. Kennedy, you know, was a cold warrior. But they both were killed before they could really fully put into effect their evolutionary beliefs. And the thing about both Kennedy and Lincoln is that they were extremely intelligent, and they did have the capacity for growth, unlike, say, Lyndon Johnson or even Bill Clinton.
Right.
I mean, Clinton, there's no evolutionary movement from Bill Clinton. He should have resigned immediately when the Monica-Lewinsky thing broke. Al Gore would have been president, and Gore, and we would have never had George W. Bush, and probably not the Iraq War. It was all, and the, you know, Clinton's impeachment was all about
him.
Al
Gore gave us George Bush anyways. He didn't fight. So, you know what?
Exactly.
You know what, Harvey? We are at 52 minutes. I think we should be ending here. I hope that I hope you will be kind enough to come back and visit our program again, because I really would love to talk to you about the Weapons in Space program. And, you know, Carl Grossman wrote a book called Weapons in Space. And I, you know, this whole thing that Donald Trump created the Space Force is a misnomer. It's a complete lie. It's an agenda that the U.S. military has been implementing for a long time, and he's rolling it out. But I'd love to have your take on that. But we are running short of time. And so I really appreciate
you can find my People's Spiral of U.S. History on my website, Tortopia.org. I've sent you a PDF, and I look forward to your review. And we can talk about the spiral of history, because basically the U.S. went brain dead in 92. Essentially, the spiral stopped, and we are now completely integrated into the global economy. And thankfully, there are some countries that are making progress where we stopped. Germany, the world's fourth largest economy, is going 100% post-nuclear, with renewables, and Denmark, other countries.
And
America's
quickly falling behind because of it, too. Harvey,
well,
if you don't mind, I will put the link to that PDF in the show notes, on the podcast notes. Would you mind if I did that?
Well, why don't you take a look at the book first and review it, and then do that.
And I will definitely put the link to your website in our show notes so people can find you and start listening to your podcast, because your podcasts are really extremely informative, and they're inspiring. They help people get the courage up to start getting active, because that's what we need. We need our listeners to take action on their own. So,
well, all the podcasts are at PRN.FM, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.FM. You can go there. I've done several hundred of them.
I know.
And you can go there and listen very easily.
Perfect. Well, thank you, Harvey, for joining us. And to my listeners, thank you for joining us. And as I say, put your courage feet on, and we will talk to you next week. Thanks for joining us, Harvey.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Talk to you next time.
Bye-bye.
Okay, take care. Bye.
Thank you for joining the Age of Fission radio show with your host, Lonnie Clark. We'll be back next week to bring you more information about the nuclear industry and the harm it's causing our planet and humanity. Find all of our podcasts on Spreaker.com or on YouTube at Nuts for Art, NutzForArt. Thank you for being part of the solution.